Well, thank you for being here. So, this evening, I'm going to talk about intimacy. We actually, if you're new here to Zen, we actually talk about intimacy quite a lot. And intimacy, as we talk about it in Zen, is about moving away from a self-referential or self-oriented perspective. But this question of intimacy can be confusing. So it's important and a little bit tricky sometimes to distinguish intimacy from the kind of codependent attachment. We probably all had a little bit of an experience with that. So attachment, as we talk about it in Zen, is a it's kind of a needy, possessive quality to it that includes obsessive thought patterns, and it kind of closes us off from life. So that's actually the opposite of intimacy, as we talk about it in Zen. Excuse me. that kind of attachment tends to distort reality, and there's a loss of freedom, a loss of spiritual freedom, a loss of emotional freedom. And when we talk about emotional freedom, we're not talking about freedom from emotions. We're talking about freedom within our emotions, even our strong emotions. And with attachment, when we lose someone that we're attached to, rather than feeling just sadness and grief, we're often overcome by feelings of fear, anguish, and resentment. So the intimacy I'll be talking about this evening is not about intimacy with a person. It's about intimacy with life, moment to moment intimacy with our activities. So it's about direct experience, another thing we talk about quite a bit here. So I'm going to talk about it by just kind of talking about certain some of the qualities or properties associated with intimacy. I've decided to talk about, you know, we can talk about intimacy from whatever angle happens to appeal to you. But the way I'm going to talk about it this evening is the qualities I'm going to talk about are without narration, non-idealism, ordinariness, attention, courage, and clear seeing. So I'm going to talk about each one of those just a little bit. And like all Zen teachings, any one of these contains them all. Any one of them contains them all. Because there's no separation between anything. That's the fundamental basic Zen teaching, is that there's no separation. So I'll start by talking about without narrative. So as long as we can stay with our direct experience, there's no narrative. Do you guys know what I'm talking about when I talk about narrative? Talking about the narrator inside our head that's telling us constantly what's going on, how we think about what's going on, even how we feel about what's going on. Constantly talking to us, constantly. But when an emotion or a sensation arises without narration, we encounter the aliveness of it, the truth that it bears, and the energy of its release. all those things the narrator, when we're the narrator, robs us of, when our mind is directing our experience, our mediating our experience. When we withdraw from life, we withdraw into our narrative. The narrator becomes our eyes and our ears. And much of the time we're only aware of what is narrated to us through discursive thinking. So when we talk, when I'm talking about the narrator, of course I'm talking about discursive thinking, right? A lot of us, you know, perhaps we're not even aware that there's a different kind of thinking. Suzuki Roshi used to call discursive thinking a primitive way of thinking. So that's kind of interesting. Tim used to call it, or does call it, spending our life sitting in the Chatterbox Cafe. Chatterbox Cafe. So when we're listening to the narrator, life, real life, close life, it just tends to pass us by. Feelings of dullness and lack settle in because we're absent from our own life. We're absent. And to experience the vitality and intimacy of life, we have to accept life just as it is. The narrator's always trying to change it. You notice that? If you don't like it, then, you know, the story changes a little bit. The narrator is a way of avoiding life, escaping from life. Constantly moving us towards what we want life to be, are constantly trying to move us away from life as it is. That's the one of the Four Noble Truths, is that is the root cause of suffering. We're always moving, trying to move away from life as it is, our move towards something that we want, and we do that through the narrator. And Buddha said that's the root cause of suffering, because we're not present for our life. We can only be present for our life right here and right now and just as it is, right? So the next one I want to talk about is non-idealism. Non-idealism. Intimacy has nothing to do with our ideas about how we think that we should think or should behave or somebody else should behave. So it's not about our moral judgments. We have to just kind of hold those very lightly. Because moral judgments are just conditioned by our culture, right? And when our ideals intrude, intimacy is replaced by judgments and criticism. And we've all kind of experienced that. You meet somebody, and at first, you know, you're just so open to them. They seem really cool. You just really enjoy being with them. But after a while, what happens? You know, your ideals start intruding. And then you start seeing them through the lens of your ideas, of your ideals, how they should be. And then intimacy is lost. And when we have an ideal about how things should be, we think less of ourselves when we don't measure up, and even less of others when they don't measure up to our ideals. So we judge ourselves harshly when we bump up against one of our ideals. We think we should be compassionate, but we feel hostility towards somebody. We think we should be more generous, but our budget doesn't allow it. We think we should be more ambitious or smarter, that we should do more or we should do less, that we should work out, that we should eat less or better. The list goes on and on. These are all our ideals, and we can become enslaved by them. So you can see why you might withdraw if the inner tyrant is constantly pointing out your shortcomings, right? And again, what do we withdraw into? We withdraw into our narration, our stories. More and more the narrator becomes our life. The more tightly we hold on to our ideals, you know, the more the narrator becomes our life. So when we're stuck in our ideals, we really only experience the tension between who we are and who we think we should be. And anger does kind of seem like a natural, appropriate response to this kind of self-imposed stress, right? Often our anger is trying to tell us something. But we really can't bear to hear, you know, anything else when the voice of the narrator is so aggressive or dominant in our lives. So, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have ideals. Human beings have ideals. But we don't have to identify with them so much that we're blinded by them, that we're even enslaved by them. So when we can hold our ideals lightly, we won't feel so threatened by the values of others. So that's what I want to say, I think, about ideals and how they intrude our obstacles to intimacy. So the next one is ordinariness or naturalness. So ordinariness is an unshakable feeling of being at home wherever we are. That's how I'm talking about ordinariness. Trungpa Rinpoche used to use the phrase "no big deal," no big deal. Pema Chodron was one of his students, and she tells the story about going to him with what she thought was a powerful enlightenment experience. Here's what she said about that. She said, "I was all excited, and as I was telling him about this experience, he had a look. It was a kind of indescribable look, a very open look. You couldn't call it compassion or judgmental or anything. And as I was telling him about this, he touched my hand and said, 'No big deal.'" So if you make a big deal out of the good things that happen in your life, then ordinariness is replaced by arrogance or pride, a sense of specialness. And if you make a big deal out of the bad things that happen, the inner tyrant just gets revved up and starts telling you how unworthy you are. So making big deals out of things, good things or bad things, good deals or bad deals, it always involves suffering. Richard Branson, do you guys know who Richard Branson is? The founder of Virgin Group, which includes Virgin Airlines. Are they still called that? Virgin Group, which includes Virgin Airlines, Virgin Records, and over 400 other companies, according to my research. He was dyslexic. He is dyslexic. I don't know if you overcome that. But in school, he was quite dyslexic, and he did poorly all the way through school. But instead of making a big deal out of it, he launched his first business venture when he was 16. And the reason I'm telling you this about Richard Branson is because I came across, years ago, I came across an interview with him. And what I remember most about it, that's kind of stuck with me all these years, is that he attributes his success to his ability to connect with others. And in this interview, he was asked what advice he gives to his executives. And he says that he tells them, just be ordinary. Isn't that kind of cool? That's the advice he gives his executives. Just be ordinary. That's what allows us to connect with others. Connecting with others is intimacy. It's also what allows us to connect with whatever our activity is, from washing the dishes to writing a poem, painting, working, trying to figure out a problem. When we can just be ordinary, then we can merge with that, whatever activity we're doing. We can connect with it. So ordinariness is a kind of natural composure. And it allows us to just feel at home, wherever we are. So the fourth quality of intimacy I want to talk about is attention. Attention, the ability to stay with whatever we're doing, stay with our difficulties. And I'm going to start talking about this by reading a story about Zen Master Ikkyu. One day, a man of the people said to Zen Master Ikkyu, "Master, will you please write for me some maxims of the highest wisdom?" Ikkyu immediately took his brush and wrote the word attention. "Is that all?" asked the man. "Will you not add something more?" And Ikkyu then wrote twice, "Attention, attention." "Well," remarked the man rather irritably, "I really don't see much depth or subtlety in what you've just written." Then Ikkyu wrote the same word three times running, "Attention, attention, attention." Half angered, the man demanded, "What does that word attention mean anyway?" And Ikkyu answered very gently, "Attention means attention." So that was in Three Pillars of Zen. It's actually a pretty famous little story. Many of you have heard it, I'm sure. So what is attention, anyway? Well, I believe that, this is just my way of thinking about it, I believe that the same way that all living things are sensitive, all living beings are sensitive to sunlight, all living beings are also sensitive to the kind of mindful attention that Ikkyu is talking about. Because when we're talking to somebody who's given us their full attention, we feel grounded. We feel grounded by that, don't we? The conversation is more alive, and we feel more alive in that moment. And I think we actually are more alive in that moment. Often when we've been around someone who is deeply attentive, we don't even know what it is about them. Sometimes we describe them as charismatic. It's kind of a mysterious word, isn't it? Charismatic. People used to describe, probably still do, Clinton as being very charismatic. But I think that charismatic is nothing more than just moment-to-moment wholehearted attention. You know, often we're talking to somebody and we can tell they're just kind of looking around. Checking their watch. We feel a little diminished, don't we? So that's a little bit about being attentive in our relationship with others. But there's a deeper level of attention or attentiveness, and that's the ability to stay with our difficulties. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about the cultivating the ability to stay with our difficulties. And he's talking about it in our everyday life. Difficulties at work, for instance, trying to figure out some problem that you're supposed to be figuring out at work. And he says that if we can stay with our difficulties, then the resolution will always arise. But it's really hard to do that, isn't it? When you're got some problem you've got to figure out at work. It's a really complicated problem. You're trying to figure it out, but your mind just keeps kind of taking off in one direction or another, particularly if you're really fearful. This is a really important problem that you're trying to work out, trying to work through. You start thinking thoughts like, what if I can't figure this out? What if I lose my job? How am I going to pay the mortgage? Am I going to buy shoes for the kids? And our mind just kind of goes all over the place. Thich Nhat Hanh says, mindful attention is the ability to stay with our difficulties. Because the resolution is always right there within the situation, right? It can't be anywhere else. So it's right there within the problem. And if you can't stay with it, you know, if your mind, the narrator, keeps taking over, telling you how unworthy you are or how terrible life's going to be. Because every situation offers its own innate intelligence. Every situation offers its own innate intelligence. Dharma gates are everywhere. Dharma gates are everywhere. In every situation. And I think most prominently within our difficulties, within our struggles. So I want to tell you about the example I want to give is of my daughter, Tiffany. She was one of her friends, a friend named Leslie, was having a baby. And she asked Tiffany, she was having a baby, she was having it at home with a midwife. And she asked Tiffany to be the second person there, like the support person. And Tiff was, she was a little excited, she said, and also a little bit nervous. In the beginning, there was a lot of just sitting and talking, mixed with a little pacing and kind of anxious laughter as the labor moved forward. And the midwife just kind of stayed back. She really wasn't involved at this point. But as the, Leslie's labor intensified, she was leaning on Tiffany more and more as they paced. So my daughter's kind of built like I am. She's not a really big person. So she was starting to get really tired. And she said that Leslie was becoming heavier and heavier. So just as she was at the point of exhaustion, here's what she said to me about that. Then something truly beautiful happened. It felt as if in the entire world there was only Leslie. The sound of her breathing, her feet moving slowly across the floor, her awkward gait, her hand pressed against her belly, her moans. So Tiffany's struggle became a path, became a Dharma gate, and it took her to the core of her being. And this is what intimacy does. It takes us to the core of our being, where there's no separation. There was no separation between Tiffany and her friend Leslie. Intimacy. That's what we're talking about when we talk about intimacy in Zen. Suzuki said that intimacy comes from doing. Here's what he said about it. Let me get this straight in my head again now. Doing that comes from a smooth, natural mind. He was actually referring to Wu Wei, but Wu Wei is intimacy. That's what Wu Wei is, a Taoist term. I talk about Taoism quite a lot in here. Wu Wei is a Taoist term, and it's just intimacy. Intimacy with our activities. And Suzuki said that it's doing that comes from a smooth, natural mind. So when Tiffany entered that Dharma gate, when there was only Leslie, her actions were coming from a smooth, natural mind. Ordinariness. No narration, full attention. So there was no Tiffany to get in the way. With no narration, there's no self to get in the way. There was no striving or no expectations, no clinging, no avoiding, no trying to escape. She was trying to escape, wasn't she, in the beginning as she was getting more and more exhausted? She was trying to escape. But suddenly, she was just right there, completely present. So this is the kind of action, the kind of attention that arises when we're fully engaged in our activity. So the next one I want to talk about, the next quality of intimacy I want to talk about is courage. Courage. It takes courage to just be with whatever is happening in the moment. Especially when it's a difficult moment. It takes courage to sit in meditation and just be there with whatever arises. Because a lot of times what arises is not very pleasant. Memories arise, resentments arise. Narrator tells us all sorts of stories and we're trying to get it to stop. And often people respond to that like, they want to sit down on their cushion and they just want to relax. That's what it's supposed to be about, right? Finding a little calmness in our life. So, I start fantasizing maybe about being in some beautiful setting, calm, peaceful field of wildflowers, or on a beach with a Mai Tai. But that's not what Zen meditation is about. Zen meditation is about being present. So I often, when I'm guiding meditation, I tell people, if you're in that very relaxed, calm place that you've created in your mind, let that go. Come back to your cushion. Because that kind of calmness will not sustain us. You know, the kind of calmness that we talk about in Zen is not a contrived, shallow calmness. It's the type of calmness that even when fear is present, even when anger is present, there's always this sense of calmness that we've cultivated, and we can touch that and be okay, even in our fear or anger or whatever is happening. But it takes courage to sit on our cushion and keep coming back to this moment. This moment with our mind spinning, this moment with fear arising, anger arising, resentment arising. But the more we practice the courage on our cushion, which is what we do here, the more we cultivate a courage that sustains us, both on and off the cushion. And while we're cultivating this courage, we're also opening ourselves up to deep insights. Because whenever we experience life directly, whatever it is, whenever we experience it directly, there's always deep insights. May not feel them at the time. Tim talks about it as like walking in mist. You don't even know you're getting wet until you're completely soaked. And often we don't realize how much we're being changed when we sit on the cushion and really do Zen meditation until we find ourselves in some difficulty and all of a sudden we realize that we're responding differently. We're not so triggered. Not quite so much fear. Or even when it is a lot of fear, it's not quite so deep. Or maybe you see something fresh that you've never seen before. Maybe you understand something new that you've never understood before. But whenever we understand something new, then what do we have to do in order to stay present for our life? Here's what Father Keating said. As soon as we understand something, we have to be detached. Not a word we like to use in Zen, but we have to let go of that understanding in order to keep abreast of the exquisite delicacies of the divine action. So that's the way a Christian teacher would talk about direct experience, moment by moment. So courage is about stepping into that uncomfortable, uncertain space over and over and over, constantly meeting our edge, constantly meeting our edge. Takes a lot of courage to do that. But that's what intimacy is about. Because as soon as you think you know something, what happens? Intimacy is lost. You're not really present anymore. As soon as you think you know somebody, you really know them. You know how they're going to act when this happens. You know what they're going to say. You can finish their sentences. A lot of times people think of that as being, oh, they're just so intimate, they can finish each other's sentences. But as soon as we hit that place where we think we know somebody, then intimacy is lost. Freshness is lost. So intimacy is a type of openness. Here's what Zen teacher John Torrent said. There's a layered quality to suffering and intense emotion. As you become interested, a tiny elf light appears in the darkest dungeon. That's the gate of emptiness. And as you become more and more interested, you walk deeper into the forest and everything looks different. Sometimes it becomes joyful right away, but it doesn't need to. It's become a path, and that's enough. Intimacy. Tim calls our strong emotions waking places. Waking places, if we have the courage to stay with them. But before they can become waking places, we have to see them clearly. We have to see them clearly. We have to see them all the way down to their roots. But seeing, the type of seeing we talk about in Zen, is not the same as analyzing. Can't stress that enough here. It's not the same as thinking about things in an academic way, trying to figure it out. It's just about staying with something and seeing it so closely that when it reveals itself, when some deep truth reveals itself to you, you recognize it. You recognize it. You're not contriving some intellectual explanation. And that brings me to the last quality I want to talk about. Clear seeing. Clear seeing. The last quality of intimacy I want to talk about. Sometimes it's called bare awareness or panoramic awareness. It's the wisdom way of seeing. It's the wisdom way of seeing. So in meditation, part of what we're doing in Zen meditation is we're cultivating the ability to just be with something, whatever is happening, in a non-judgmental, unbiased way. That's the only way that this kind of clear seeing is going to arise. Just seeing. So in meditation, as you move closer and closer to yourself, you begin to understand yourself much more clearly. You see how you replay the same tapes over and over. And when you're playing the same tapes over and over, Tim calls it autopilot, when you're on autopilot, people and situations change, but your experience remains the same. And in meditation, we can start to see that. We can start to see that clearly. In meditation, you begin to let go of the words, the stories, and then you're just sitting there. And you, in the beginning, you start to realize that even the unpleasant things, you often just relive over and over and over in your mind, the story of your emotions. Or maybe you start to see that you tend to dissociate, and you start to see these things about yourself. They start to reveal this, reveal themselves to you, this way of being in the world that you have are now conditioned to be. We start to see our conditioning. So on one level, clear seeing is about clearly seeing how we relate to the situation of our life and the habitual patterns that limit our life. Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, who is the father of Soto Zen, he talked about this kind of clear seeing a lot. He said to forget the self is to become intimate with all life. To forget the self is to become intimate with all life. And he is referring to forget, to let go of, to see clearly our conditioned way of being in the world. And once we see that, then that creates the possibility that we can get the self out of the way. And then we're able to be intimate. To forget the self is to become intimate with our life. So clear seeing is about first being intimate with ourselves so that we can free ourselves to be intimate with others. And then finally, free ourselves to become intimate with all life. With all life. The Zen point, poet Hanza described intimacy with all life in this way. This is pretty cool. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountains appear. The moon sets and the water is cool. So that's Hanza. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountains. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountains appear. The moon sets and the water is cool. So that's what I want to say about the qualities of intimacy. Without narration, non-idealism, ordinariness, attention, courage, and clear seeing. And one opens into the other, naturally and authentically, because there's no separation between them. But it does help to look at them separately, to recognize them when we're experiencing them, and recognize them when we're not experiencing them. So on the program, for those of you who have the program, I wrote this Zen koan. A lay person asked a Zen master, "Well, what is so special about Zen practice?" And the master replied, "When I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I rest." The questioner said, "What's so special about that? I eat when I'm hungry and rest when I'm tired." And the master said, "Yes, but when I eat, I know that I'm eating. And when I rest, I know that I'm resting." So he was saying the same thing as Dogen said when he said to forget the self is to be intimate with all life. And the same thing that Layman Payne was saying when he said, "What is my mysterious power? Chopping wood and carrying water." So I've given a lot of talks in the last few years that I've been here, and all my talks always focus on the same thing I talked about tonight. Sometimes I call it spiritual freedom, other times dealing with strong emotions, other times it's Wu Wei, Taoism. I talked about happiness once, and the purest form of happiness is true intimacy. Sometimes I talk about it as Buddha nature, or our true nature. But the practice of all of these is total engagement with our activity, not separating from our activity. And when we talk about intimacy in Zen, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about cultivating the capacity to hold a non-dual consciousness. Non-dual consciousness. That word non-duality can feel, seem really intimidating to people. But it's just intimacy. That's all it is. It's just intimacy. Non-dual consciousness. So I'm going to end with this from the Tao Te Ching. As if we do nothing. Our practice is one of natural effort. It seems as if we do nothing, yet everything is done. As we walk this path, resisting the temptation to control, each thing will naturally evolve according to its individual situation. When our conditioning arises and starts stirring things up, we return to the simple stillness of our natural state. When we abide at this still point, our conditioned habits naturally fall away, leaving only peace. So that's what I have to say about intimacy. And we have some time for questions or comments or stories of your own. Sure.
You drew a distinction between letting go and detachment, and I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I said when I let go, let's see, I'm going to, the specific reference when I did that is when I was quoting Father Keating, and he used the word detached. So in Zen, we don't use that word too often. We prefer like letting go. I mean, because it can be confusing. Attachment is confusing. Being detached and can be confusing for people. So I just prefer to use the phrase letting go rather than being detached or detaching from. So I'm trying to get at what your question is. So were you asking me to say something more about being attached?
It seems like maybe that detachment is then sort of a barrier to total engagement.
Well, this is where the confusion comes in. When we talk about being detached in Zen, which is kind of archaic, I think, you know, that term in Buddhism, being attached, being detached, I mean. But they were talking about as a good thing, but it was more like being detached from all of our, in a way that allows us to be intimate with all things. So when he used the word, though, in that Christian quote, it was used in a different way. So I just kind of put in letting go instead because that can be kind of confusing. A lot of the words, in, like emptiness, which is a really good thing in Buddhism, but it can has a negative connotation in our culture. So when there are words like that that tends to be confusing, I try and come up with some word that we're more familiar with. Does that answer your question? Okay. Anybody else? No?
One thing I was thinking about is that to know the self and then hit the self.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're talking about the previous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about knowing the self. And the paradox is that, you know, it's a pretty goofy person, you know. It's up and down and all around.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a part of me that doesn't want to be too hard on them. Want to see that in such kind of harsh. Sometimes we can feel it happen when we find ourselves concentrating our thoughts and feelings.
Idealism. What we think we should be like. Yes. Is that what you mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that to know yourself the way Dogen was talking about it was the only way we know ourselves like that is through intimacy. And so that means without idealism, without the judgments, and, you know, the courage to just be there and kind of set that aside, you know that. I mean, because if you're experiencing something and you don't want to experience it because you don't want to know that about yourself, then what you're experiencing is all your judgments about stuff. I mean, so intimacy is lost, knowing the self is lost, being present is lost, direct experience is lost, which means all those other things that I talked about. We're stuck in them. The narrator, without narration, you don't have any of that. Judgment always comes with narration, right? Do you agree with that, Paul, or not?
I think there is a space in there about the narration. But we're not quite so harsh on that that we can feel the paradox of it. It's actually, we can laugh.
Yes. Yeah. That's kind of, we can get to that place. We don't usually start there, though.
Right, but there's a gain.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. You have to be pretty quiet. Oftentimes think of it as like a wave, and there's still points, mm-hmm.
And that was what I meant by the calmness that's not contrived. It allows us to hold two different, seemingly opposing experiences almost at the same time. Because we're holding them loosely, right? If you're holding one too tight, then you can't. Holding them loosely. Thank you.